Welcome to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. Today, I am chatting with Dr. Rowena Forsyth about digital health and communities. Rowena is a senior lecturer in digital health at the University of Sydney, and she is a health sociologist focusing on qualitative digital health, cyber psychology, medical tourism, and online communities at the University of Sydney. Welcome, Rowena. I'm so delighted to have you on board.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation, Carolyn. I'm looking forward to our chat.
Rowena, before we get chatting about what you do and your research, can you tell me a little bit more about yourself and then what the pivot point was for you in terms of getting into cyber psychology?
Okay, so I guess my undergraduate degree was in sociology quite broadly, and then my PhD was in health services research and health sociology, where I looked at professional relationships of health professionals, particularly doctors and laboratory staff, transitioning from a paper-based to a computerized pathology ordering system in a hospital. So there I looked at things like professional boundaries and the relationships between professionals. And through that, I got really interested in information, how information was communicated, how it was designed, how it was prioritized, really. So how different groups derived social status from the way they used information. So that was sort of the way in there. And then after that, I sort of went away from that for a bit and I worked in different things, and I worked in bioethics for a little while. And there I worked on a project looking at consent for bone marrow transplant. And through that, it was a qualitative project, and we had interviews with health professionals, with patients, with their carers. And it was a really in-depth project and really wonderful results. And part of that research, I became really interested in the collective and collective decision making, so how people used information together. So there I really thought about, you know, how did each of those people play a part in that decision making? And I was really, really proud of the paper that I sort of led from that work, and that was something, just really an interest that then continued. And I think the thread through everything has been really, how do people use information in health for decision making, for community involvement? And I think that's now been my interest, which has led me to a lot of what I'm going to talk to you about today, which has been in the collective. How do we use technology together? How do we use information together?
So you focus a lot of your research on the social psychology of side of things, and done quite a bit of studies in medical tourism, especially when it comes around to online communities. And as you were talking about, the collective side of things. And there's been quite a lot of uptake in medical tourism, so people traveling to other countries in order to get medical procedures done. What are the main things you've learned from your research so far?
So I guess that the main outcomes from looking at that population of people is, apparently it's quite a big population of people who are medical tourists. So in 2015, it was estimated that there were 5 million people worldwide who were medical tourists. So when we're talking about medical tourists, what we mean are people that choose to travel away from their home country to another destination to receive medical or health care. Okay, so health tourism is a bit broader, which can be sort of wellness and spiritual retreats, but medical tourism is really about health conditions and procedures. So this can be a whole lot of things. Dentistry is a very common area. Reproductive health, cardiac surgery, all of these sort of things. In our study, we narrowed it down to cosmetic procedures, which are a very big part of that as well. And we found that, you know, allegedly there are 20,000 Australians a year who are traveling for as medical tourists, and that the majority of these travel for cosmetic procedures. But we found that it was sort of quite hard to find these people. So, you know, usually if you were looking for a patient population with a health condition, you would find other patient groups, advocacy groups, or you'd recruit through hospitals and health services. But these people are not attending local health services. So we advertised online and through a few different local publications, and we found people for our study. And I guess we were interested in a whole lot of things. Just what was their experience beginning to end? How did they make decisions about becoming medical tourists? And then how did they experience traveling, receiving procedures and recovery? So I guess our main sort of findings from the project were firstly, around the transition of online relationships to offline relationships. So what happened with our medical tourists is they found other medical tourists online, particularly through Facebook, and they joined, which were closed groups available only, often only to women and only to people who were there to talk about or discuss overseas cosmetic surgery and who were Australian. And these groups were often based by country, so the Philippines or Thailand or Indonesia were the popular ones for our medical tourists. And in these groups, people found each other and developed these really strong bonds. So one of the really important things that came out of it was that the relationships that they formed online actually transferred to offline relationships and became about a whole lot more than just cosmetic surgery. So whilst people were joining these groups initially for things like information and support seeking, so basically around, you know, which hospitals, which procedures, which doctors, also should they go ahead with it, they were feeling quite nervous, they were looking for that sort of emotional support. So they found those things. They actually became quite closely connected to other people in these groups, which led to these longer-term friendships. We had people who did pet sitting for each other out of these groups. We had people travelling interstate, so they would actually travel quite long distances to see each other in person. And part of that was sometimes about seeing the outcomes of the procedures. So they would actually show each other their bodies and things, but, you know, they were quite open to doing that with each other. They would also plan future surgeries together or future trips overseas as sort of buddies for each other to have future procedures as well. So, you know, there was certainly this depth of connection that came through in these groups for something that started out, you know, very focused on a particular thing, became these deeper, long-lasting connections. So that was really nice. One of the things we talked about was that we thought that maybe these connections came from the fact that these people didn't just have shared experiences, but they had shared stigmatized experiences. So for most of our cosmetic tourists, they actually found that they didn't really disclose to other people in their lives, their family and friends, that they were planning overseas surgery, and they felt it was really stigmatised. But then they went online and found that they weren't stigmatised at all and they had this shared experience. So that's one of the ideas that we had. It was because of that shared stigmatised experience that they had these connections. The final thing I'll just say that was our main finding was that when they'd received their procedures, a lot of them then continued their membership of these groups and they assumed this provider role where they actually, you know, enacted this reciprocity to give back both, you know, information and emotional support to the next round of prospective cosmetic tourists. So this was really a generalized reciprocity. So it wasn't direct in that they were reciprocating back to the people that had helped them, but more that they paid it forward to other kind of new people on their journeys that came in. So that was a really nice part of it as well.
I'm fascinated by there's 20,000 Australians a year who go for these medical procedures abroad. And considering the Australian population is, what, 22, 25 million? That's
quite, not even. Yeah.
Yeah. That's quite a substantial portion of the population, relatively, that goes for the medical procedures every year. And if there's still the element of social discrimination, and which there seems to be, because if they, otherwise they wouldn't go online and they wouldn't have these closed groups where you had to be vetted before you actually come on board. What I'm trying to get to is why people had this underground movement in a way and not willing to share their medical procedures with family and friends.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly the case that there were people who never told their colleagues that they'd had procedures, even after they returned to Australia, recovered well. I don't know that it can be explained as sort of a closed shop and, you know, keeping it for a special few people. I think it's just that people think there's a lot of misconception out there and that people think they're being you know, my relative is going to go overseas and be hacked to pieces in some, you know, back street clinic, you know, in with unsterilized equipment. And the reality of it is that's actually not the case. And if you go online and see some of these hospitals, or actually the term is used in the literature as hospitels because they're more like hotels, and you can choose the room you want, the food's excellent quality, the practitioners there are top notch, and the majority of people actually have very, very good outcomes from this.
Do you think that the more people who go for these procedures, and the more they kind of talk about it openly, the more open the general population will be to accept these kind of procedures? Because in some ways, in my head, I was thinking about menopause, for example, that used to be a hush-hush topic. You kind of whisper it behind your hand when you talk about it. Now it's a general open discussion, and it's not so embarrassing anymore to talk about menopause. So do you think it may get to that point, especially with online communities and being more open online with these discussions, that it might become more socially acceptable?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the concern that people might have is that there is the commercial side of it. Obviously, these are all privately paid for, and there would be concerns about people being exploited, potentially, who are vulnerable. I mean, the people that we had in our study, when we set out, we thought, oh, they're all going to be kind of young and looking for kind of idealized bodies and having multiple procedures and things like that. What we actually found was that the people in our study were really just average people. They were people who had thought about having their procedures for a really long time. They took it really seriously. They planned things really precisely. They investigated lots of options. They, in many cases, they dipped into retirement savings and things to afford the procedures. So it wasn't about necessarily becoming sort of an idealized celebrity body or anything like that. It was more about, you know, people saying they'd been unhappy with themselves for a long time. You know, our women said they, you know, after having their kids, they had sort of skin folds and things that they could never get rid of with diet and exercise, and they just wanted to feel a bit better about themselves and things like that. So it was a really well-considered thing. Nobody was kind of doing this flippantly and outrageously.
We spoke in our initial discussion about kind of self-identity issues, because as you said, a lot of people associate these kind of procedures with the wealthy, the rich and famous, who want to have these idealized bodies and still want to be 20 when they, or look like they're 20 when they're 65. But these are just average people who are wanting to just do something that's to their bodies, because their bodies and their faces don't quite match with how they see themselves. So what are the kind of things you found in your research around the personal struggles? Because you kind of touched on that, but is there anything more in terms of their self-identity and how people visualize themselves and their mindsets, and also around mental health as well? Because I'm guessing this has an impact, their self-identity or what they see in the mirror has an impact on their mental health and well-being based on how they see themselves visually versus mentally.
Oh, and that's exactly the thing. You know, it's that people were thought they wanted to look different. They wanted to look how they used to look. It wasn't about going from an A cup to an E cup for a breast augmentation. It wasn't about having anything very extreme. It was about having fairly straightforward. I mean, there are really extreme procedures that you can have, and you can go online and research all of this. There are, you know, designer vagina procedures if people want to pursue that sort of thing. It's certainly available. I think, you know, a motivation of why people might go overseas versus have these procedures at home might be partly about separating these things from their normal lives, but it more tends to be around the time frames and the cost, basically. So if you were to have multiple procedures in Australia, they'll be spaced out for a large number of weeks and they'll be very expensive. Whereas in these places, they're cheaper. They're not cheap by any means, but they're cheaper. There's sort of really good aftercare and follow-up care in the facilities there. And they often do more of the procedures closer together as well.
And we also spoke about because there are hotels and there's quite a lot of recreational activities around the hotels, we spoke about some of the dangers as well that could be associated with this procedures. I wonder if you can kind of touch on that a little bit.
As humans, we're not always very good at understanding risk. And, you know, there have been cases where, you know, it's people do get kind of caught up in the moment and are looking at sort of the outcome of what's going to happen and do kind of, they're excited to finally undertake these procedures that they've thought about for a long time. And then often as part of these trips, people have sort of a holiday element in it at the end, and they actually go and have these procedures and it's actually major surgery. And the recovery is not always easy and or pleasant. And there have certainly been extreme cases of people kind of, you know, getting to the holiday part a week after major surgery and then doing leisure activities like hopping on a jet ski and their stitches bursting and some really serious consequences. People have died and things, but that is not the experience of the vast majority of people. They often travel with a family member or a friend or a buddy who's also having procedures, which some of the companies that facilitate this type of travel, where they book kind of packages for you with accommodation and the procedures, they will actually kind of buddy up some of the patients that go in advance. So people do, you know, people in our interviews really talked that they had a few really rough days immediately after their procedure, you know, but then were sensible about it and didn't push it.
And I suppose this is where the online communities come into their own, because there is an element of, as you say, paying it forward, where those who've gone through the procedures go through the process of saying, these are things you need to think about, these are the things you should avoid, or these are the risks and just be careful of. So they kind of give people that insight that they might not have thought about otherwise.
Oh, definitely. And we had, you know, people who, even once they'd returned to Australia and were recovering, they would be sort of looking at their stitches and looking at the wound healing, and you know, they'll take a photo and post that in the groups and say, does this look normal? You know, because they don't necessarily want to go to their local doctor because they might have discouraged them from going overseas or to have the procedures in the first place, and they have nobody else to ask, really, you know. And then there's this trust and this reciprocity, and they know people are going to be kind in these groups, so they'll post the photo and they'll say, you know, we had a nice quote where, and he said, oh, how's this healing? You know, how are my stitches healing? And we've got this lovely quote where the participant says, they said, no, that looks a bit yucky. I'd get down to emergency. And, you know, and very non-judgmental. You know, people genuinely wanting to help each other. So that was a really nice part of it.
I guess this is where online communities really come into their own, and the bonus of having all this technology and this availability of just giving support to people who really need it rather than it being a bad thing.
Well, absolutely. And this has exploded, you know, particularly in the last 10 years, is it's been not only can people find out information about facilities and procedures and doctors, but they can find connection with other people online who can tell them the reality of, this is what it felt like for me when I took my body through this process. And, you know, and are very willing to share. It's a really nice part of it.
It's not just personal communities that are developed online around healthcare. There's a lot of professionals who build communities online. And you've done some research on looking at healthcare professionals and how they present themselves online and kind of on privacy issues and the line between professional selves and personal selves. And there is, you spoke about before, about there being real different opinions about how much you divulge as a professional about your personal life. What are the main things you've learned from your research so far on this?
Okay, so this is a study that we started about 2 years ago, and it's still in progress. We finished our data collection now, so it's a mixed methods study, and we recruited anybody with a health profession qualification and using at least one online platform to connect with peers. So we found that there's quite a bit of research around already about health professionals connecting with patients and also patient communities, but not so much about health professionals connecting with each other. And we also wanted to look across platforms and across professionals as well. So that's our analysis we're doing at the moment. In terms of privacy, we found that privacy is something really at the forefront of people's minds. They manage their online identities really carefully with these accounts they create. Some people have separate personal and separate professional accounts, sometimes with different names. So sometimes we had a female participant and she had her married name on one account and her maiden name on another account. Some people don't separate these things and they use their same name across all their platforms as well. So some people talk in terms of, look, it's really important to be authentic. It's important to show exactly who I am and what I do, and I'm the same everywhere. Other people are really cautious, though, about what they divulge and what they present from these accounts as well. Partly this is tied to institutional and regulatory oversight. So some tensions there about some people are very, very careful about not disclosing the facility they work at. Being really concerned that things that you would post online with your credentials and your professional opinion and expertise could actually be sanctioned by the regulatory body that allows you to practice. And that there were instances of people having their registration affected by things they posted online. So people really managing that tension as well. Again, some people don't care. Some people put all their information very clearly out there. Everyone can find out everything about me. I've nothing to hide. Whereas other people are keeping things really separate. Some confusion as well about codes of conduct at their institution, so their hospital or their health service, and what the actual guidelines were about what they could post and what they couldn't. You know, could they post if they were in their uniform and post a video or not? Did they have to cover over the institution's name? You know, what the boundaries were there. So I think that's a challenge we face in this space in terms of evolving technologies and user-driven technology. You know, there's no kind of standard about things. Something else we found that really is interesting is that the way that more junior people use these communities is a bit different to the way more senior people use them. So as a generalization and without getting into the nitty gritty, because we're, you know, haven't got there yet, but senior people seem to have this very broad view. They're able to engage internationally. They're able to keep up a lot of different platforms. They're able to keep up a lot of different engagements with different people as well. Whereas our more junior people, perhaps because they're so busy starting out in their professions, but their networks are much more localized. So they're within their health service. They're within their particular clinical team, for instance. They just haven't got kind of the time or the headspace, I guess, the bandwidth, or however we might talk about it, to have those broader, bigger engagements. So just seeing that as a contrast and whether that will change over time is an interesting part of it as well.
Because it is a potential lowering of professional boundaries. And in so doing, a lot of patients will probably get some insight into their doctor or their dentist or whoever they go and see. Do you think, and there are some benefits or disadvantages to this from the patient perspective in terms of how they see the professional when they go into their offices or for an appointment, what kind of impact do you think that may have?
Well, I think from the patient perspective, it perhaps makes their practitioners a bit less scary and makes them a bit more human. Maybe they feel like they can have that connection a bit more. They have a way into conversation or making small talk but at the same time, I can't see that the practitioner is then following the patient's social media account. That's just not going to happen, right? And whether they would even have the interest to, I don't know that that's there. So again, it's not going to be a mutual conversation. I guess the kind of the downside of it might be that, in losing that distance, is there the potential that they'll see that their doctor has certain political views or is involved in a particular type of work that they don't agree with. I think you've had a case in during the COVID lockdowns in Melbourne. There was a doctor, a specialist in Melbourne, who during the restrictions actually had a big family dinner and posted about it on social media, and it was became sort of a thing about people transgressing lockdowns. So whether that affected their patient profile and their patient attendance in either a positive or negative way, I think would have been really interesting. So, you know, it's interesting how the professionals then maintain boundaries. And I think that's a big part of it is, are there boundaries? Boundaries are much more permeable now. And that's sort of a tricky part of it.
I wonder if this goes back to the disinhibition effect that John Souther posted or researched and published about decades ago.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I think one of the, if we talk about boundaries as well, I think the time boundaries are interesting. So like we know with these sort of technologies, and this is part of what's come out for our health professionals as well, is imposing limits and boundaries on time particularly becomes more challenging. So, you know, it might be that the patients also feel like their doctor or health, other health professional is should be available to them outside of normal working hours, that they can contact them by direct message through these technologies at any hour of the day and night. So we had a nice example from somebody who's a specialist in an Asian country, and he has quite a long identifiable name, and he has his real name across multiple platforms, okay? So patients can contact him on WhatsApp, they can contact him all sorts of means through the internet, okay? And then one of his accounts is his Instagram, is his travel blog. He said, that's what I use it for, is all my travels around the world, I post on there about it. And he said, just the boundaries of it are interesting because he's, yeah, we have this lovely quote where he says, you know, I was on the beach, you know, and I had a photo of myself in my Speedos on the beach. And he had a patient direct message in response to that photo saying, oh, can I make an appointment for my mother to come and see you about her hip? The boundaries are just dissolving for this sort of stuff.
And I suppose you're right. It does make the professionals more human. It's more, and people accepting that there's a bit more of a blurring of that professional personal boundary, and it's okay because now I can actually divulge a bit more of my personal life to them, and I don't feel so embarrassed, and I don't feel as though I have to hold that back because they're professionals and they're on this pedestal. Actually, they won't judge me, and it'll be easier for me to divulge those details.
With our participants, though, I mean, they did feel like they could control this a bit. Like they knew they could make separate accounts for their professional life if they wanted to. They could put a different name on it. They could not accept followers. It was still something they felt like was in their control to manage. Even if there was this sort of bleeding between them in lots of ways, it wasn't necessarily problematic.
So there are a lot of practical benefits for professional online communities for healthcare professionals. What are those? Because there is a lot of specialists in the healthcare industry. So what about those online communities for professionals?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of benefits come out of them, particularly in the area of sort of education and professional development. So things like keeping up with developments in the field, whether that's sort of conferences coming up, you know, latest practice developments, sharing papers, sharing articles and things like that. So Twitter in its older form was really popular for that. It was felt like it was a really easy way to share information and connect with people. It was a nice way to keep a professional presence because you weren't kind of, you know, letting people in on personal details, but you could show your professional credentials and you could keep up with those developments. And people would have really great professional discussions in the comment sections of an article, for instance, and debate findings and applicability to practice and things like that. We had some nice things where people would, be commenting on a post, an article or something like that, and they would end up connecting with somebody in another country who they'd never met, never heard of before, and then ultimately ended up writing a publication together. So there were that sort of knowledge sharing, but also those professional development benefits that were really nice out of it too. There was also for people a bit of a shared sense of belonging. You know, we're facing similar challenges in our work and sharing some of those challenges with potentially with patient cases or dealing with patients' families. You know, it's a rare case. We haven't had it at our facility before, but how have other people dealt with this? Or what would other people recommend? And then people within those communities, again, being a lot of them being quite closed communities. So you're having to say that you've got a professional qualification in a certain profession to be a member. And then people really sharing that with each other. It was interesting as well how these communities changed over time. So people would sometimes have a group that they all joined together because they were the same graduating class in a year old physiotherapist. And then they continued this through. So 10, 12, 15 years later, they still had this community. And, you know, they would talk about, well, initially it was about people finding jobs or getting their registration up to date. But then it became more about sharing practice and expertise as they developed as well. So an easy way to keep in touch with people, finding relevant content and content of interest to you within the time that you've got available was really important. So people finding where the particular hashtags to follow, particular accounts to follow, often things like institutional accounts are things like some of the big hospitals in the US and the UK, for instance, will put up, you know, a de-identified patient case and say, what's the diagnosis here? And everybody loves to jump in and, you know, not only share their own knowledge, but also, you know, add an article or, you know, there was always a sense that if you're making some kind of claim that you should be backing it up with evidence as well. So people using it in a very professionalized way.
I guess that goes beyond medical communities and online communities amongst professionals who specialize in a specific area are vital for sharing knowledge and gaining professional development. It's so much easier now that we have these communities internationally rather than just your local five people in the whole of Australia who might specialize in this one area. And you're currently working on a project with adolescents in the Pacific region. And this is really based around physical activity, nutrition, and digital health using a trauma-informed approach. Can you tell me more about this project?
This project is about 2 years in, and we're working on a co-designed approach with adolescents and young people in schools. So our target audience is 12 years and up. And we're looking at how they can use digital health as part of their education about nutrition and physical activity, as you said. So we're trying to understand what tools do they use now, what sort of literacy they have around using these tools and how they can use them better. So we've been to 4 schools so far. So we go and we have a survey, but then we have a workshop where we go and have a booklet that has a scenario in it about, and part of the trauma-informed approach is not asking people directly about themselves, but we actually give them a scenario of fictionalized characters with names appropriate to that setting, who are doing things similar to what they would do. So looking for food, shopping for food, or participating in sporting activities. And then they follow through, you know, where do you go and do these activities? How do you do them? What are some of the things that affect these activities? And then how do they employ digital technologies as part of that? And then we have a creative part of it where they're actually designing future technologies that could be relevant. So that's been really lovely. So we've been to 4 schools. So 3 in New Caledonia, 2 urban and 1 rural, and then 1 in Australia. So we're expanding the project at the moment, hopefully to other Pacific countries as well. We did some pilot work in Vanuatu. We're hoping to do the project in Solomon Islands and also in Fiji potentially. So, and expanded in Australia as well. So far, that's where we're at. We're madly trying to write up the publications, as everybody will be aware that these things never go as fast as you want. But, you know, we know that young people are using these technologies. We know that they're accessing health information online. We know that they're accessing a really broad range of content. I mean, in our early results so far, we found that 81% of 13-year-olds had a smartphone in our study so far. So, and a third of them are searching for fitness and nutrition information online. The platforms they're using are YouTube, Google, Instagram, and TikTok. So some of it's quite interactional and some of it's sort of searching for information and reading. And they want stuff that's free, up to date, and easy to access. So how can we make those technologies better? How can we, you know, improve the literacy of young people with using these technologies? Because they're a part of their daily lives. They're not going to stop using them. But how can we help them use them better is really what it's about.
When do you think the results of the project will be published, kind of guesstimate? And I know it takes ages to get it, pull it all together, but what is your current predicted, hopefully?
We're hopeful that something will be out next year. So we're also publishing it as a methodology protocol as well, because it is something that the approach that we've used we feel has been very successful. We've had a lot of consultation through the process with schools, with you know, different academics in different areas, very much a multidisciplinary approach. So we definitely see it as something that could be leveraged into other areas of health or different fields as well.
And you are currently a senior lecturer at the University of Sydney. Do you see an increase in interest in practical application of cyber psychology kind of around the Sydney area, but also then in Australia in general?
Yeah, I mean, we've had, you know, some difficulties in sort of bringing a full course to fruition, but certainly from different honours students projects that we've had over the years. So we've now, we're on our third honours student on the online communities project. We're on our second student on the Pacific project, you know, and then the publications that we had from the cosmetic tourism project were with one of the honours students. So although the publications take time, we are getting quite an interest in students wanting to know more about how online works and in these specific areas as well. So it's been really pleasing to see people are interested in being critical and bringing that together. You know what I mean? It's, I think, you know, absolutely we're concerned about young people and keeping safe online. But we're also seeing, I think, an evolution towards more sophisticated conversations about how do we do this well? How do we use these spaces beyond just online communities, but particularly for online communities, about, you know, how do we use these things for our benefit? How do we manage them in ways? How do we stay in control of them? And obviously AI is presenting a huge challenge and there's lots and lots of interest in that as well. But people really wanting to understand how can we use these things for good.
What do you think the future is for cyber psychology in Australia?
Well, I hope it's going to grow. I think it's been something that certainly, you know, I've been very fortunate to work with Andrew Campbell in our cyber psychology research group and our colleagues there with Christina Amon and Brad Ridout and our students there about, you know, all having a focus and all working really well together in promoting this area of study. I think we're gaining more profile and, you know, certainly we're very interested in having more PhD students, HDR students of all sorts really coming to join us and, you know, push the work forward. I mean, we've got Emma Van der Swy, who's one of our students at the moment, and her PhD is on video gamers and mental health. And it's absolutely glorious, her work. And I'm sure if your viewers and readers have been to SciSci conference recently, you will have seen Emma's work and she's an absolute star. And, you know, it's an area that there are so many parts of it that we could go into, you know, so many different parts of the internet and what are people doing on them and how can we help them to do it better? I think that's really important. You know, I know there's lots of dangers and I know there's some really troubling elements, But we also need that conversation about what's working well and how can we move towards doing more of that.
Because that's really what cyber psychology is. It's helping us to understand how we do online as an individual level and how that impacts us and how we can do it better, rather than all the negative stuff that comes around. And Australia is slightly more unique than, say, UK and America because of the diverse population and dispersed population geographically. So there's a lot, there are different challenges in Australia to what there are, but there's also a lot of similarities from an individual basis as well.
Oh, look, and I think a great strength of psychology as a discipline, you know, it's something I'm relatively new since joining Andrew's group 3 or 4 years ago, is that it is multidisciplinary. You know, we can bring different perspectives from other social sciences, such as myself, the legal side, the ethical side, and we need all of these perspectives to make it grow and to address the complexity of what happens online and how do we understand it. Absolutely.
We're coming to the end of our podcast and there's three standard questions I normally ask all my guests. And the first, Rowena, is what is the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
It would be that, you know, how do we grow it and how do we go from here? And I think it's just finding the right people with the passion to do this kind of work. And I think that's something we all do this sort of work because we have a passion and we love it. And we want to understand the complexity of it. Certainly with online communities, it's not about developing or defining a best practice standard of how to be a member of an online community. That is not what this type of work is about. We're saying that there are many, many legitimate forms of interacting online, which are equally valid, and we can be different types of personas in different communities that we're in. We can be more active. We can be more of a lurker. And all of those things are equally valid. You know, but let's understand why and how people do that. So, you know, I'd absolutely really welcome if anybody wants to engage with me and potentially go into a PhD or go into really in-depth study on this, I'd really welcome to hear from them.
So the second question I ask everyone is around the frustration a lot of cyber psychologists have with journalists taking snippets of academic findings and kind of twisting them slightly to create negative social narratives and clickbait around digital technology. Do you think journalists in general are getting better or worse at accurately representing sound academic findings?
Oh, I think it's very challenging. I mean, the space that they work in, the 24-hour news cycle, the having to get to the punchline quickly and all of that stuff make it really, really hard. I think it is something where people really need to think about, you know, what are the consequences of what they publish? And, you know, a bit of clickbait can have such serious consequences. And reinforcing and recreating moral panics all the time about the dangers of social media, which are absolutely out there and I absolutely acknowledge that they are and are very, very important that we address them. But also having a more balanced view and promoting good sides of things is really important as well. I think there's some really, really good sources around that are improving this conversation as well. And one of them is a publication called The Conversation, which I think, you know, was Australian originally, but I think has a US and UK arm now. And that's a really important bridge between academics and getting academics to write for that publication. And it's prestigious to get into. It's difficult to get into. But that's just, you know, it's becoming so accessible for people. It's free, it's online, it's available everywhere. If people can engage with that and some critical thought and some expertise and not be afraid of it, I think that's just so important. And, you know, we were talking as well about the danger of some of the way the algorithms work of, you know, is that you might see a particular view on an issue and that matches with your political beliefs. And then you just see many, many more of exactly the same things that reinforce your point of view. And that consumption of news in those ways means that you are less and less likely to see dissenting views or opposing views. And just the behaviour of engaging in these technologies, you know, has led to that in a way as well. Because if you think about back to the old days of a print newspaper, you would actually have the newspaper laid out in front of you. And okay, you might not have read every single article in it, but you would glance across it at the very least, and you would see different points of view or different articles across it. And so you would be much more aware of dissenting views and opposing views. And I think just that way that these algorithms work, or and just the sheer volume of information that's out there now, is it's very easy for people to go down shorter, you know, potentially more sensationalized information that is just reinforcing their view all the time. And I think keeping that those skills up that we all need, it's not just for our adolescents, which is something we're really focusing on as kind of our future adults, but you know, as adults, we need to keep up our skills in being critical and finding alternatives and taking a step back and considering things before adopting a position always on something. You know, it's not easy. It's a bit uncomfortable and it's a bit hard, but yeah, it's an important thing to keep up, I think.
And just there isn't a kind of echo chamber effect and of unintended consequences of AI algorithms being, oh, you like this, or no, actually click on this because we think you like this too. But the other thing is really around the word critical. It's about us being critical, not critical to others, but critical of the information that we are using and filtering that in a way that we think, oh, is this right? Is this just sensationalized, or is it clickbait, or is it actually real? So that's the kind of critical mindset that you're talking about.
And just our, you know, digital literacy skills, taking a step back and thinking, who wrote this article? Why is it written in a particular way? You know, what's their desired outcome from this? Or, you know, and it's, is it the fast-paced nature of information turnover that we're not doing that as well as we used to? Yeah. I don't know.
And the last question I have for you is, any particular favorite cyber psychology book, reference article, researcher that you would recommend for others to read in your kind of specialities around cyber psychology?
As I've said, I'm a relatively new cyber psychologist of only a few years. So my recommendation is not really cyber psychology as such. It's more on the medical tourism side, because I know when we were talking, and it's a really interesting subject and something that certainly is very complex and has a whole lot to it. So there's a book by some UK researchers. Ruth Holliday is the main author, along with Meredith Jones and David Bell, and it's called Beautyscapes, Mapping Cosmetic Surgery Tourism. So this was a book within the last 5 years, I think it was 2019, and it's something where they've done a really in-depth study of a large population of medical tourists originating in the UK. Also prominent in this field is John Connell, who wrote a book called Medical Tourism, which again is a long-term study of this as well. So something a bit left field perhaps for this audience, but very well written and really interesting reads.
Because actually that'll give a really good psychological insight into why people do medical tourism. And then so if you want to translate that into cyber psychology perspective, it's just how they then would go about searching for information and why they'd go online to find these communities. So it's a great recommendation. Rowena, thank you so much for joining me in Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It's been so much fun chatting to you. And I really do hope you come back on board to talk a little bit more about your research and give it updates, and especially around the young people and adolescents that you're researching in the Pacific area. So thank you so much, and look forward to chatting again soon.
Thank you so much for having me, Carolyn. It's been wonderful to talk to you, and absolutely happy to come back and chat about the next phase of all this research.